are listening to the Gaming World Order, episode 360. This is Flat 2. We're talking about Groth. Groth is a documentation format and a documentation command that comes with Slackware. And it's probably on your system right now, even if you're not running Slackware. Groth is the powerhouse behind man pages. The whole man system kind of runs on, well, it's written in Groth, I should say. It's not really, it doesn't run on Groth, but it's written in Groth and it's rendered as man pages from Groth sources. Groth is, of course, GNU Trough. It's been a fun language to kind of explore. We're in the thick of it now. We're out of the thick of it. We went through the thick of it last episode, I feel, and the episode before that. We learned about requests and arguments and different rendering libraries or preprocessors, rather, for equations and chemistry output. And now we're just kind of mucking around with all the utilities, so a bunch of related utilities. The first one we're going to talk about is gdiffmake. G-D-I-F-F-M-K, gdiffmake. It generates a sort of a diff file of sorts. It's not quite what you might be used to if you use diff, the command, to generate patch files on a regular basis. This is related, but not the same. If you've ever done a git diff, that kind of thing for diff and a patch file, that's similar but different than gdiffmake. Gdiffmake creates... I guess we can just do some... We'll demonstrate what it does. It has notation to show changes in a file. So we're going to call... We're going to generate a... I'm in my demo folder here. Yes, I am. Okay. So I'm going to create a new file called example.1. And we know how to do this, more or less. We'll do .th for the heading line. And we'll put example in quotes. I'm putting example. That's probably enough, actually. And then .sh. Oops. .sh for a subheading. This is just an example, the quotation, and then we'll do, let's do a .pp for, we'll just put this is an example graph file. This is a paragraph in the file. Okay, so pretty simple little file here. It's a four-line file, but it is valid, and now it exists. And I'm going to copy that example 1 to example.old.1, and then I'm going to open up example 1 again. So this will be my current version of this file. And I think I'll change the name of this example to hello world. So that's the .th now says hello world instead of example. And I'm going to add a line between this is an example graph file and this is a paragraph in the file. And I shall write, I like to type on my computer. And I'll save that. So now it's a 5-line file and it has a changed line and an added line in example.1 compared to example.old.1. So now if I do a gdiffmake, gdiffmk, and there are three required arguments. So one is the old file, so that's example.old1. The next one is the current file, so that's example.1. And then the final argument is a destination file. Actually, I shouldn't say that's a required argument. It's not required. It will dump it out happily to your terminal if you leave that command, that option out. So I'm just going to call this example.patch, even though this isn't actually a patch file, but that's kind of how I'm thinking about it. All right, so now we'll take a look at example.patch, and that's, I mean, it just ran, like, the moment I hit return, it was done. It's a very quick command, especially when your file is only 5 lines long. Okay, so I'm opening up this little patch file here, and it's now my file is now 9 lines long. It used to be 5, if you'll recall. And here's the reason. So it opens up instead of, you'll recall that I put a .th as the opening line. Well, now it opens up with a .mc, so this is a new request. We know requests now when we see them, and we know that that's a new one. We don't know what that is, so if we go to Firefox, or a web browser of your choice, and we look at the documentation for Groth online. There's a section where it tells you all the different requests that are available. And sure enough, if you do a search, a case-sensitive search, you'll find the .mc. And it turns out that this stands for print a margin character, mc, to the right of the text. The first argument is the glyph. The second is the distance away from the right margin, by default 10 points. Now that may not make any sense to you, but we can look and see what it means. So what it's done is it started this thing .mc and then a pipe character. And then it has our .th line with hello world on it. So not the old one that said example, but the new one that says hello world. And then it closes the .mc request. Or rather, it makes a new empty request. And then there's our subheading. This is just an example. And then our paragraph. This is an example graph file. And then there's the .mc request again, this time with a plus sign after it. And then there's that new line that we have. I like to type on my computer. And then it makes a new MC request that is empty. And then there's finally the final line of the file. So what we have here is a modified graph file with the modifications marked, clearly marked in it. You notice that it's not a diff file though, because now a diff file, traditionally you'd see what was removed in order to make way for the new stuff. If you've ever done a diff file, you know what we would have seen normally, like in a git diff, certainly, you'd see a negative sign by the example title, and then immediately after that, plus sign, and then the hello world title. So you know what's been removed, you know what it's been replaced with, or whether it's not been replaced at all. But this patch file, it shows you the new stuff, but it's just marked up. So if you do, for instance, if we get this thing to render, in this case it won't work with less, because less doesn't know, I've named it something weird, and less isn't seeing it as a graph file right now. So I'm just gonna do man example.patch. And we see the little tiny man page formatted as such. So it has the hello world title up in the top left and the top right. And then it's got my little paragraph heading there that says this is just an example. To the far right of that line, very right side of my man page here, there's a pipe. There's that character that we requested, or that gdiff make requested for us, to be printed in the right column, and it's a pipe symbol showing that it has been modified since maybe last time we saw it. And then there's the paragraph. Now remember, in graph, one of graph's jobs is to eat carriage returns, to eat the new line character, so it did. It took, I like to type on my computer, this is a paragraph in the file, and instead of printing it on two separate lines, it becomes one line. And at the end of that line, on the very right-hand margin of this man page, there's a little plus mark, so we know that something's been added to that paragraph. And that's it. It helps you visualize changes, I guess would be a good way to describe what that does. Next up is G Lily Pond. Lily Pond is a music notation language, I guess. I mean, music notation itself could be described as a language. This is a language for computers so that you can type in ASCII and generate really nice musical notation on a treble or bass clef or whatever. Whole notes, half notes, quarter notes, 16th notes, all that stuff. It's a powerful language. I've known people who use it with great success. It is quite nice. I haven't really done much with it myself, but I know a lot of people do really, really like it. Other people hate it because, you know, it's a complicated, it is a language that you have to learn and type and stuff. And with applications where it just shows you the staff and you can just click on things, you know, like MuseScore, for instance, this is sometimes a hard sell. But if you are a person who uses LilyPond, then GLilyPond helps you integrate LilyPond output into a graph document. So you kind of have to back up and separate all of these concepts, especially if they're all new to you. So if you want to do LilyPond, you don't need graph. LilyPond is its own thing. It just so happens that someone wrote an extension or a macro for LilyPond, for Graph, that accepts LilyPond input and integrates that with your Graph document. So in other words, you might be a music theorist and you're writing a paper about some kind of musical principle, and you want to do a little sample staff of notation between two paragraphs. That's what GLilyPond would enable you to do. You wouldn't probably use GLilyPond if you were sitting down to write down a composition for use later on, or for an orchestral score. You wouldn't do that with Graph. You would just use LilyPond. That's all you need. Okay, so that's, I just wanted to kind of get that straight so that I'm not confusing you and you think, oh, it's Lily Pond sounds great, I want to use it, and then you think, oh, but then I have to learn Graph. That's not, they're not related at all. This is a tool within Graph that allows people to mix their Graph with their Lily Pond. That's all. Okay, so now that we understand that, Lily Pond, it says, GLilyPond integrates LilyPond parts into Graph, and it's a bit confusing, but here's what it does. It's a lot like EQN and Chem, really, if you think of it that way. Which the workflow of that I think is a little bit confusing, and it's going to be confusing again here. But it's GLilyPond transforms sheet music written in the LilyPond language into the Graph language using the .pspic request, such that Graph can transform it into a format that can be displayed directly. Files in Graph language and standard input can be provided as arguments. Okay, so we know from this that we need two things. We need some Graph, we need a Graph file, and then because the point of this is to transform LilyPond into integrate LilyPond with Graph, we need some LilyPond in our Graph. So I'm going to open up example.1. Again, I'm going to save it as example. No, I'm just going to actually, I'll just, we don't need to save it. We'll just do it right in here. Example.1. At the end of this document, remember this is the 5-line file, hello world. This is just an example. We're going to put .lilypond.start. And if you're guessing that that's a request and an argument, you're correct. And then I'm going to import some LilyPond notation that I just downloaded from the internet, specifically from lilypond.org. They've got some training material there that kind of demonstrates for you what this notation means and how to do it. So this is LilyPond. It's about 20 lines of LilyPond notation, and it starts out with rhmusic equals / relative c, quote, quote, curly brace, / n, new voice, / new voice, curly brace, r2, c4 dot, g8 pipe, bes1 tilde pipe. You see why people don't like this. Like people who are used to just clicking around on the staff and so on, this can be a difficult thing for them to grasp. But there you go. That's what it looks like. It's pretty cool. It's code that produces musical notation. And at the end of this block, did I say it was 20 lines? I meant it was more like 40 lines. At the end of it, we're going to do .lilypond.end. So that's not entirely foreign to us. It's a request. We're sort of tagging the input and output, the beginning and the end of this foreign language that we suddenly have pasted into our Graph document, and we're marking that with so a special request. Now, of course, Graph by itself does not know what that request means. All it sees this new request, .lilypond, has no idea what that means, and that's because it's not meant for Graph. It's actually meant for GLilypond. Now, as it turns out, this program won't run without quite a couple of dependencies. So it turns out that it needs Perl file homedir, and which in itself requires file which. So you have to install some Perl dependencies if they're not already installed, or if you're not on Slackware, your package manager may have already installed that. But on Slackware, certainly, interestingly, this application that ships with Slackware does not actually work without installing two extra Perl packages from slackbuilds.org, and then in turn you have to install LilyPond because GLilypond requires LilyPond, and that doesn't ship with Slackware, or I didn't install it in the first place. But I do see that it's in slackbuilds.org, and usually if there's something in slackbuilds.org, that means it doesn't come with Slackware. So this one I think maybe kind of snuck in there. Or rather, maybe it didn't sneak in there, maybe it's included, but if you want to use it, it does require extra applications, which is a reasonable, I can see it both ways. On one hand, it is reasonable, because it's like, well, if this thing comes with Graph and is Graph-related, then why not include that thing with the rest of Graph? Why drop it when anyone saying, oh, cool, Graph comes installed, is going to kind of expect that GLilypond is installed, maybe, in theory. So you have to just install some extra packages in order for it to actually do the thing that it's meant to do. On the other hand, it is kind of weird to include a software that literally won't work unless you install extra things without any kind of like notation about, oh, by the way, if you want to use this thing, you have to go install these other packages. Anyway, to be fair, this is a very niche activity that we're doing right now. However, I wanted to see this work, so I installed the Perl file Homedir and the Perl file Witch, and then I installed LilyPond and the FontForge and other related dependencies for LilyPond. Now I'm ready to go. So the first thing we'll do is we'll just watch glilypond work its magic. And by default, when it does, it just dumps the output to your terminal. So we'll do glilypond dash dash pdf to eps dash, I'm going to have to look up what the long option for this dash t is, I forget. It's something like dash dash temp. It is dash dash temp underscore dir. So glilypond dash dash pdf to eps, and that's just, we're just controlling how LilyPond processes the LilyPond music in the document. And then dash dash temp underscore dir, and then dot slash b. Now all that is, what I'm doing here is I'm saying I don't want the temporary directory to be slash temp slash LilyPond slash klaatu slash grof or something. There's a big long temporary directory that it uses, and I don't see the point. I want my temporary directory to be local, right here in the same directory. I'm going to just call it B for build, because I really am kind of lazy when I type. And that's the command, except we need the input, right? So for whatever reason, glilypond wants, you have to separate the options from the argument. And I think that's probably got something to do with the fact that it, by default, it will allow input from standard input, maybe. I'm not sure. But anyway, you have to do a dash dash. And then it's like space, dash dash, space, and then the rest of the command, the argument, the file you want to process, which in this case is example.1. I guess instead of doing it that way, you could also just do a redirect pointing to the left, so a less than symbol, example1. You could do that. Either way, the result is a tiny little graph file, in this case, because my graph example.1 is only 5 lines. Of course, we've stuck 40 lines of LilyPond in there, but it's reduced it back down to 6 lines. So all that LilyPond code has now been transformed by LilyPond, well, by glilypond, but through LilyPond, into a .ps pick statement. So we've got my graph file, all 5 lines. And then there's a new line at the end where the LilyPond used to be, and it is .pspic. So this is a PostScript preprocessor, and then the path to this EPS file. EPS is an encapsulated PostScript. We know what PostScript is because in a couple of episodes in the past, we were talking about GhostScript, and we even wrote some PostScript by hand. So we're familiar with this format more or less. It's just right now it's been encapsulated. Encapsulated, EPS. You can also put PS into, well, certainly a printer, but into a big bloated file format like PDF. So it's a relatively flexible format, actually, and it is text-based, and it is vector-based. So, or it can be, anyway. I mean, it can have other stuff in it, but generally that's what it does. That's what it is. Okay, so there's PostScript. That's a PostScript file. It exists now, but we want to go further with this. So what we will do is we'll do glilypond dash dash pdf to eps dash dash temp underscore dir dot slash b for our temporary folder, and then dot dot, there, I mean, dash dash example dot one, and we're going to redirect the output of that to example dot ly dot one, ly being the common notation for a LilyPond format. So I'll just use that here to indicate that, hey, this is the one with the LilyPond in it. Well, actually, you know what? It would make more sense, actually, to do example.ps.1, because really that's what this is. Okay, so anyway, we got example.ps.1, whatever. And that produces this file, which is the same thing as we just saw on the in the output. It's a graph file. It has one little .ps pick line at the end. So if it's a graph file, how can we process it? Well, we know that we can process graph files with graph, so that seems like a pretty reasonable place to start. So let's do that. So we'll do graph Actually, let's look up in graph really quick what we need to start off to start a preprocessor with PIC. And we know that last time we used this command with chem, if you'll recall, you may or may not recall, but we did. And it's just dash P as in PIC or preprocess, I guess. So we'll just do a graph dash P and then a dash capital T for our target device. And in this case, now we've been doing a lot of PDF targets lately, but in this case, we're just going to do a PS. So dash capital T PS for keeping it PostScript. And then the input file, which is example.ps.1. And once again, if we don't do anything here, we could get the output in the terminal. We could look at the output. And sure enough, that looks vaguely like PostScript to me. But what I'm going to do instead, because I don't need to see the PostScript, I don't need to see the source of the PostScript, I just want to see the output, the render. So I'm going to redirect the output to out.ps. No, example.ps. How about that? Example.ps. And then finally, last but not least, I'm going to do an ocular of example.ps. Ocular being my PDF and PostScript viewer on the system. And here we go. There's I like to see I like to type on my computer. This is a paragraph in the file. Scrolling down, there's my lily pond output. And there's a little footnote there, music engraving by lily pond 2.18.2. And that's it. And that is how you use glilypond. Should you ever, ever, ever need, for whatever reason, to integrate music notation with your graph content. Now you know. That was a lot. Let's take a coffee break. Coffee in hand, ready to tackle the next group of graph-related commands. I'll be honest, the next group of graph-related commands, I'm gonna kind of fly through because we've gone over three preprocessors now that basically, like if you look at my examples, certainly on the main on the website, newworldorder.info, you look at the examples in the show notes, or if you'll just think about them, you'll realize that they're all basically they're starting to boil down to the same workflow. They're not certainly not the same thing, but they are very, very similar in how they're executed. So whether you're doing a mathematical equation or a chemical representation or a lily pond file of music, it starts with your graph document that you're working on anyway, presumably, and you do a request for a new format. So a little breakout section, like graph, ignore this section, this is not graph, this is something else. So whether that's a dot EQ for equations and dot EN to close the equation, or a dot C start and dot C end for chemistry, or dot lily pond start and dot lily pond end, or whatever it was, whatever it is, you demarcate where your third party language starts and stops. Then you put your third party content between those requests, and then you run a preprocessor. I think that of all the steps, that seems to be the most confusing. Like the third-party language itself it is what it is, but how to process it once you've got the third-party language, that seems to be a little bit less clear, but it's also something that's very flexible because it kind of depends on you. Like what are you looking to generate from, how do you want to represent this? Are you generating a PostScript? Are you generating a PDF? Are you doing something else entirely? It obviously depends largely on what your intended workflow is. So that's the workflow in general, and it is the same for preprocessors alike. And here's the next group of programs. GPerl. GPerl, preprocessor for Perl parts in RAW files. So with the Perl preprocessor, you start a Perl block, a code block, with .perl, with a capital P, or .perl start, whichever one you want. Again, I like explicit, so I would do .perl space start, and then you do your Perl code, and then you end it with a .perl capital P space stop. That's it. Then you've got Perl code in your graph document, and you run it through the gPerl preprocessor to turn that into a recognizable document for whatever else you want, however else you want to process it, whether it's a further processing with graph itself or grapher or something else entirely. It's up to you. Okay, next one is gPinion. I'm probably not saying that correctly, but this is the Chinese European-like writing within graph. So this is a preprocessor, again, for graph. It allows you to add Chinese European-like language, pinyin, into graph files. Pinyin, well, first, let's slow down, step back. So to start the pinyin block in your graph file, of course, you do a request, right? That's what we would expect. So that would be .pinyin space start, or you can do .pinyin space begin, whichever you prefer, and then .pinyin space stop, or .pinyin space end. All of those things will work together, and one starts and one stops the block. Within that block, you place your pinyin, I guess we could call it markup, or we could say notation. The pinyin notation is, well, it's essentially a romanization version of Chinese, and it's based around a set of syllables, about 400 or so syllables, and combined with 5 different tones. And you mark this up just in ASCII and place it within the pinyin requests and then run it through the preprocessor, and you get pinyin rendered correctly in graph. Okay, next up is grap2graph. This is another script a lot like eqn2graph, which we covered in the previous episode, if I recall correctly. And it converts grap diagrams to a bitmap, to PNG or JPEG, or anything that ImageMagick Convert supports, which is practically everything. I've never heard of grap before, and apparently it is kind of an old format from early ROF days, and when GNU ROF came out, for whatever reason, it didn't implement grap. So someone named Ted Faber took it upon himself to develop grap, an open source version of grap, and it is located from lunabase.org/tildefaber/vault/software/grap. I'll try to remember to include that in the links. Point is, you need grap in order for grap2graph to function. So you'll have to download that and compile it and install it, or maybe your distribution has it in their software repository. You could check that, I guess. The compile was not terribly difficult. He kind of issues a warning on the page, on the home page where you're downloading it. He says, deity help you if you try to use auto tools or something like that, which I thought was kind of funny and unusual, because that seems like the obvious solution for the compiling of this. And also, when I did compile it, it worked as expected, so I'm not sure what reservations he had about it. But it's AC local auto header auto make dash dash add dash missing, and then auto conf, and then /configure make install. Being on Slackware, I didn't make install dest dir equals temp, and then grap dash whatever the date is to represent the git checkout. I guess I should probably use a hash for that. But anyway, I did that, installed it, it works. Luckily, grap comes with several example files, because I wouldn't have known where to find a grap diagram without the examples. So if you get the grap source code, you do find some example files in the example directory. And for instance, you could do, let's look at this, cat internet.d, that's apparently a grap diagram.d, and then pipe that to grap2graph dash format, let's do JPEG, dash density, let's do 300, and then redirect the output to my.jpg. And then if we do a display of my.jpg, we get a graph. It looks like it's .graph. It has dots along it, an x and y axis, neither of which are exactly labeled. I mean, they're labeled with numbers, but I don't know what it represents. That translates the graph and the diagram to a bitmap graph. Next up is GRN, which is short sort of for gremlin. Gremlin apparently is some kind of graphing software or language. I was unable to find a whole lot about it. I shouldn't say graphing. I guess I mean rendering or maybe illustration even. Drawing would be another word for that. So it's some kind of language apparently for drawing shapes and figures on screen, but I couldn't find, well, really anything about it. The man page is the most I could find about it, and the things online reference the manual, or I was able to find the manual over and over again. I could not find the thing about the file format. Now, there is something new on Apache.org that talks about Gremlin as a graph query language, a graphing query language. I do not believe that this is the same thing. This is something that was from the something called an AED, which I don't actually know what that is, and then there was a Sun Microsystems /X 1.1 implementation of this language, and you prefix a block of Gremlin code, which looks a lot like just number coordinates, like 0.24.0.0.128.0.0.2.240.00.128.00, and so on. And then there's some shapes like triangle or polygon. So it seems like it would be a language that you could almost comprehend. Like, I kind of have an idea of what that would look like. I can plot 240. That was the word I was looking for, by the way, plotting. I can plot 240 and 128 in my head if I can give me a Cartesian graph, and I'm just, I sort of picture that. But, and from 240, 128, I can then pretend like I could go 185 down to 120 and then back up to 240. Along the 120, you know, so you kind of have that notion of what that would look like, but I can't find the program that translates that into an actual thing, whether it's, I don't know, ASCII shapes or bitmap image or whatever. I just can't find it. So you prefix the block of Gremlin code with the line Gremlin file or Sun Gremlin file, because apparently there's a slight difference between the original Gremlin file spec and the Sun Gremlin file spec, but I was not able to find those file specs. I could not find what I was supposed to use to process those coordinates and then end up with something that looks like a graphic. Again, the one on Apache.org, which you will find if you take it upon yourself to hunt this down, you'll think, I'll bet I can find it, and I'll send class you a link. You'll find the one on Apache.org. I do not believe that's the same thing. That seems to be a graph query language. That's not what this is, as far as I can tell. So anyway, this Gremlin file format, you can write within a .gs request and close that request with a .ge request. Everything between that should be Gremlin language, and then in theory you should be able to process this Gremlin file through the GRN preprocessor for Groff. Now, I've been able to do that. The problem with what I've been doing is that it doesn't give me anything but either Groff or it'll give me PostScript. I can get it to PostScript, but the PostScript is just the literal Gremlin code, like spelled out, you know, like instead of in ASCII font, it's in PostScript vectors. So I can't get the thing to translate. So anyway, I'll just say that GRN, as far as I can tell, should work mostly like EQN, for instance, or CHEM, but I don't know if I'm missing a dependency here or if I'm just doing something wrong that that I'm not catching. But you know, all the usual sort of commands like GRN, GRN example dot ME piped to, well, for instance, Groffer dash P dash ME dash capital TPS redirect to my PS, that sort of thing doesn't seem to render any results for me. There is a note in the GRN man page. In fact, only the dash ME macro package has support for .gs, .ge, and .gf. Now, that seems on the surface like that should be okay, but if I do, well, obviously if I do a graph, I'm going to need graph input. So I'll make a sample dot g something. Well, let's just do a sample dot graph, for instance. And then we'll do an input of dot th quote hello gremlins, and then we'll do a dot gs to start our block, and we'll do sun gremlin file, and then we have some gremlin code, so 0240.00128.00, and then the number 2 on a line itself. I don't know what any of this means. 240.00128.00185.120, and so on. So I'll just let that sort of go on for a little while, and then dot ge to end the gremlin block. Now we can invoke, in theory, graph space dash me. That's the macro to process this stuff, as far as I understand. Sample.ge. Now I'm not going to redirect this output because I want to see, well, I will actually, I'll type it through less. And less, sure enough, it confirms that it's giving me a postscript document. So now if I do that and redirect it to my.ps and then do an ocular my.ps, I get in return a very literal PostScript version of what I've entered. So it literally starts with, this is some graph text, and then it shows me the text signed gremlin file, and then the numbers that I've typed in. So there's nothing, it's not being translated into anything. So apparently that's not working as far as I can tell, and I don't know where the breakdown is exactly, but at least we know that GRN exists, and that at one point there was a file format called Gremlin, and if you know anything about it, I'd be curious to hear more. I'd be very interested in hearing about whatever Gremlin file was used for, and maybe even what processes it, because I can't find it to save my life. Okay, next up is GrowDVI. That's convert graph output to DVI format, which is a text format, apparently, the TEX, like LaTeX. Text DVI format is what it's called. And the idea is here that you're essentially running graph dash capital T DVI. So you're telling it, you know, we run dash T PDF or dash T PS. You're telling it to use a driver called the dev DVI for its output from graph. And if I have a sample graph file, which I do, sample.graph, I can do graph dash capital T DVI sample.graph, and then redirect that to blah DVI, run file on blah.dvi, and it confirms that it is a text DVI file. I could look at that, presumably in probably Ocular, should know how to translate that. Yes, it does, and that renders correctly. So I'm not exactly sure why one would need a DVI file. I've never really used one. I think that's the closest I've ever gotten to a DVI file just now. So I'm not sure what they're good for or what they're useful for, I should say. But that is how you can go from graph to DVI. And that's an important concept, really, the whole driver concept. I don't know if I think I did mention that in the very first graph episode, but I kind of feel like maybe I should reemphasize that you can, yeah, we were talking about fonts, I think, but you can learn quite a bit about graph's capabilities by looking in /user /usr/share/graph-whatever version it is. So this is 1.22.3/font, and that lists, do the ls command, that lists things like dev ASCII, dev DVI, dev HTML, dev Latin 1, dev VLBP, and so on. There's dev PDF, there's dev PS, there's dev UTF-8. You might remember some of these from that very first graph episode. The idea here is that it's using these drivers to produce output of a certain type. So if you do have graph document, and you think, okay, well, I've done the unthinkable and I've switched my entire workflow to graph, but I just realized I don't need a PDF output of this particular document or a plain text one, I need HTML. Well, you could do that by just setting your target device to dev HTML, and then it would use dev HTML to translate your graph file to some other format, which is quite useful. Okay, so here's the next one, and this is kind of cool, and I think maybe this is the one I'll end on, because it's pretty neat. It's a little bit grapher. It's a little bit like grapher, the application. It is a guessing graph command, so it's grog, G-R-O-G, and it guesses options for a graph command. It will read the input of whatever you throw at it, and it tries to guess which graph options are needed to perform, to process that correctly. So for instance, if I do, and this will be an arguably poor choice of an example, but if I do a grog sample.graph, then it tells me that the options that it believes I should use are grof-g, which we'll have to look up in the man page for grog what that is. Oh, pre-process with grn, okay, fair enough. Dash man sample.graph. So I'll run that command, grof-g for the pre-processing with grn, dash man sample.graph, and I'll redirect it to, I don't know, my.ps, and then I'm going to run, oh, actually, it errored out on that already. It doesn't know what to do with something on line 5, which is some numbers. 0, 0 on line 5, it doesn't understand what that is. It doesn't understand a font name that it thinks that I'm trying to give it in the Sun Gremlin file line 4. So that obviously did not work successfully after all. That's too bad. Let's try again. Let's do grog grn example.me. That one, it just says it doesn't understand at all. It's an undefined subroutine, doesn't know what to do with that. So I'm having poor luck with these sample grn files, and that's okay. I didn't really expect it to do all that much. So then grog, let's do this man page here, this innocent looking man page that I have. And that one, it identified correctly. It told me, okay, grof-man sport.8. I look at it and it produces some postscript for me. Of course, I could redirect that to a postscript file, and then I'd have a postscript version of that man page. So, grog is, again, yeah, it's guessing what you want to do. It apparently defaults to postscript output. I'm not sure why, but I mean, maybe that's just the typical output format for who their audience was. Maybe it's because they're assuming you're using this in order to send it to a printer. I'm not sure, but that does seem to be the default. Now, if I do grog-t HTML sport.8, then it correctly, it'll understand my additional option, and it'll add it into the mix of the command that I should run, which is, for instance, grof-T HTML-man sport.8. So if I ran that, I'll just select that line and click and hit return, and then it outputs HTML for me. So it's doing what I want. It's telling me how to get there. That seems pretty useful. That is probably it for this episode. I mean, there's more. There's yet more to go through from the grof package, but we are in the last sort of screenful. So that's good news. Hopefully, some of these were either interesting or just insightful, because grof, I feel like most of us ignore it. It's generally considered an archaic markup language. And to some degree, I will say that I kind of see why. I mean, I don't know how easy it would be to process grof manually. I mean, that said, I don't know how really easy it is to, or I should say automate the processing of grof. I mean, sure, you can automate it with grof, but in terms of, for instance, if you realize you actually meant one tag and not the other, how easy is it to go in there with sed and just fix everything in one go? That's kind of my personal judgment of how good or bad a markup or a markdown language is. Kind of, you think, well, how easy is it for me to hack on it without anything too specialized, or without learning an entirely new language of some sort. And that can be difficult. I mean, XML, for instance, is quite difficult to process on your own. You either have to be very clever with your regex, or you have to learn something like XML Starlet or XPath or something like that, and that can get pretty complex, or Beautiful Soup, whatever. It can be complex. I don't know what the easiest one is. I don't know that it would be grof. I don't know that it wouldn't be grof. Maybe I'm not thinking about it broadly enough. I mean, not having written extensively in it, there might be, I can't think of what I would want to change in that way anyway. So maybe the relative absence of tags in many ways seems like it could be an advantage. But the unpredictable nature of some of those tags does seem a little bit more complex. I don't know. I'm not sure. The other reason I think that it's considered maybe slightly archaic or arcane is that in some of these preprocessors, there does seem to be potential for interference. Now, to be fair, I don't know how often you're going to have to run some text through both, I don't know, grap to graph, as well as EQ in and ken. I'm just not sure how often that's done. Maybe that's a classic combination that would happen very frequently. I don't know, but there's a couple of warnings in some of the man pages that says, hey, if you're running this through this preprocessor, make sure you run this one before you run that one, that sort of thing. So that seems a little bit clunky that the man page would have to sort of warn you about the order of something that wouldn't get caught in the command at the time of execution. So that makes me a little bit concerned, and we will continue to look at it in the next episode. I think we'll probably end it, we'll probably finish it up in that episode. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Thank you for listening to the Renew World Order on cast. This has been Klaatu. You can reach me on IRC. I'm on the Freenode network, usually in channels such as Augcast Planet, Slacker Media, Slackware, a couple of others. My nick on IRC is not Klaatu. You can also reach me lately on Mastodon. My username there is @klaatu@mastodon.xyz. Of course, you can email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. That's klaatu@member.fsf, as in Free Software Foundation.org. And of course, you can visit my various websites, newworldorder.info and slackermedia.info. I will see you next time.
You know, of course, that you are living in a power age. You cannot get away from this power. What are you doing with it?